up a fucking digital copy. Hello, it's us again.
Hello, I'm Andy.
Hello, I'm Rav.
And welcome to Stardub 2.13.
Yes, 2.13, unlucky for some, but not for us. For once again, you've stumbled upon the most exciting podcast on the internet. Other podcasts bring you breaking news, cultural events of great significance, possibly some Olympic talk. We merely talk about the aspects of pop culture, which not enough people talk about. Today on Stardub, we have...
We're going to start on a little bit of a somber note.
It's true.
Before battling into some recent comic events, Ralph's going to moan throughout for reasons which will become clear very, very shortly.
Indeed.
And we're going to talk about a film from the late 60s that we both went to the cinema scene last week.
It's true, from the space year 1967, no less.
But anyway, so first up, obviously, we're recording this on Wednesday, July the 11th.
2012.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the actor Ernest Borgnine recently left us.
It's true. Most people will remember Ernest for such work as Airwolf, The Black Hole, SpongeBob SquarePants.
And Willard.
Yes.
Where he, we believe, won an Oscar.
Yes, I believe he did win an Oscar. However, today, in tribute to the great man himself, we are going to talk about Laser Mission. What is Laser Mission?
Laser Mission was an action film, I believe called Soldier of Fortune elsewhere, which starred another personality no longer with us, Brandon Lee, the son of Bruce Lee, also no longer with us.
Most famous perhaps for being in the Crow film.
Yes.
The Crow film, which did not in any way have any kind of curse upon it, you internet cesspool dwellers.
Yes.
So he's a chap. He's a mercenary man.
He's a mercenary man.
It's true, there's a theme tune, and he's a mercenary man, and he goes around and does mercenary things. Now, the most important thing to discuss when discussing Laser Mission is that at no point do lasers actually feature within any sort of mission.
At all.
Of any kind. It's like, I don't know, going to see a film called Robocop that doesn't have a robotic cop in it of any description, or perhaps a film called Star Wars which involves no running amongst the stars. Purely against the Trade Descriptions Act. So anyway, he's a young chap.
Ernest Borgnine plays a man of dubious accent who we're obviously meant to believe some kind of Eastern European scientist who's come up with some rather splendid weapon that will...
A splendid weapon, and everyone wants this weapon. And Ernest himself has a very fetching hat.
Yes.
Which is very important. And one of the things that Ernest could do well would wear a hat.
It should be pointed out that Ernest got third billing in this film and really was in it for all of about 10 minutes.
It's one of those, it's in the grand tradition of many films of that ilk where people like us go, oh, I'm on YouTube, I've just been a film with Ernest Borgnine in it I've never seen before. I like him, he's good. And not in an ironic way, as in, I did genuinely enjoy the actor and watched many a thing he was in just because he was in it. That includes all of Airwolf. Which actually isn't very good.
Not much we're united on this. Jan Michael Vincent playing Jello on the cliffs. Fucking get out of yourselves.
I enjoyed Airwolf as a child. I enjoyed the theme tune today. I enjoyed the Ernest because he was never a bad actor. But it's not very good. But anyway, I still have fun memories of it. So I clicked and thought, oh, Ernest, this will be good. And he turns up with his hat, says something in a dubious language, vanishes again, reappears on the beach at one point. Encourages young Brandon to go off and do something important, and there's a lass in it
Who pretends to be his daughter but turns out is some agency spy for the CIA.
Agency spy. So hijinks ensue across the desert during the day, desert during the night,
where they don't freeze to death and die.
Where Brandon Lee takes an astonishingly long time to realise that he can quite easily pummel such a lass who's on this laser mission with him.
Should clarify just now, pummel, we don't mean actually beat her up or anything. We're not advocates of violence against women. What we mean is poon her. That's right, she wants the Brandon Lee Bobby.
Now this is one of the important things about action movies, tosh action movies, and that's what Laser Mission is. It's a very specific requirement, and the very specific requirement is there will be a chap, there will be a lass. They won't quite like each other initially. There'll be a bit of friction, but you can tell that before the film is out, they'll have made the beast with two backs. It's not about love or to get tenderness or togetherness. It's just about let's give the audience a cheap thrill.
Yes.
And everyone likes a cheap thrill from time to time. So Brandon takes a very long time to realise that he can get it on. Various evil bad men turn up with guns and jeeps and shit.
There's a slave mine.
There's a slave mine, but it's not a very good slave mine.
And there's also the two inept soldiers from Cuba, who one of whom is a woman,
mm-hmm.
and has obviously been masquerading as a man throughout.
Yeah, they turn up as comic relief.
They're not comic, they're not relief.
No. And as the film goes on, you find yourself thinking, where is Ernest going to reappear? I like the Ernest. He does eventually appear at the end, and what's important about his appearance at the end is that by this point, all the exciting plot strands are coming together. Brandon has found the evil laser missile type MacGuffin weapon thing. The lass is there, they've got it on, so they're quite happy. The evil bad man is there, they're all in the desert. And Ernest turns up and acts his little cotton socks off. He emotes like no one can emote. It's almost like he believes in this drama. He believes in this. The bad man gets blown up and then comes back to life, and you have to run him down in the jeep.
Yes.
And then the film ends.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. So, Laser Mission is available on a certain popular video sharing website.
Yes.
Possibly available on DVD, but I wouldn't advise it.
No.
It's watchable. It's watchable in company. If you've got some beer, it's fine. It's not Ernest's best work, but it's worth mentioning, and the reason why I mention it is because of two things. It was the last thing I ever saw with Ernest Borgnine in it, and my compatriot here actually thought that Ernest had passed away. I did some research and found out that not only was he still alive, but he was still working. Imagine my surprise 2 weeks later when he passed away, which was unfortunate. Because we did want him to get to 100, because he was 95.
And still a jobbing actor. So.
And still a jobbing actor, still doing a voice in SpongeBob SquarePants, but up until the end. And was still acting in various stuff such as the final two episodes of ER, for which he got an Emmy nomination at the grand old age of 92, which isn't bad at all. So, that was Laser Mission.
Yeah. So, other missions that we've embarked on.
Yes,
Great segue. Recently we attended the second Glasgow Comic Con.
It's true. yes, we did.
there was a lot of things discovered. Jim Starlin telling us about the AIDS box in DC Comics.
We'll get on to the AIDS box in a second.
I discovered why I really don't like organised religion. It's nothing to do with anything to practice. It's more to do with the fact that, fuck's sake, those seats in Catholic churches are goddamn uncomfortable.
All these facts and more to come in an exciting Glasgow Comic Con roundup. So for some background information, Glasgow is in Scotland, which is in the UK. Anyway, for Scotland being a place which has spawned many a famous comics writer and artist, people like
Grant Morrison, John Wagner, Alan Grant, Frank Quitely,
John Chapp, who wrote Kick-Ass, Mark Miller. Thank you very much. The publishers DC Thompson, Beano Dandy, Commando, various stuff like that. So there's quite a wealth of talent in Scotland, but not just talent, but very successful and influential talent. So the thing is, there have been sort of small conventions going on and small meetups, but it's been very strange is that across the main central belt, there's not really been a big...
Not since the days of Glackac.
Yeah. And considering that, particularly in the last, say, 10 years or so, the likes of Brian Hitch, Grant Morrison, Mark Miller really coming to prominence, it's been kind of strange that such a thing hasn't happened. And in Glasgow, it used to be a thriving sort of, well, small scene of comic marks, but slowly but surely, over the 90s and early 2000s, they dwindled and moved to smaller and smaller premises, and eventually completely combusted. And I think that killed it for a while. So last year, some people decided, let's try a convention, and did a one-day convention in a converted church, the Rennie McIntosh Church, which is in Maryhill, in Glasgow. And it's at the nice end of Maryhill, not the sort of, well, less than salubrious end of Maryhill.
The target end of Glasgow.
I can say that with some confidence because I have relatives who originally come from Maryhill, and I'm from the west end of Glasgow originally, and as a visiting support worker, visited many parts of Maryhill for 5 years and saw some very rough things there. So thankfully it's in the right part of Maryhill. So they tried it on in a church, and it was a reasonably small scale event. And they packed about 500 people in. They had Mark Miller there, a small dealer's room, and some local, I guess, like Jim Alexander, for instance, turned up. There's a bit involved in that. And lo and behold, it was a big success, and he actually sold out the tickets within 2 weeks of putting them on sale. So, nice to see. And obviously it did well enough that they decided to not only bring it back this year, but expand it, firstly to make it a two-day event, and also to expand slightly across to a small community hall, which is across the road. So we went on the Saturday. What happened then?
Well, just the previous, the guests, the big, there was several guests going, obviously Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely, being probably two of the bigger ones.
Yep.
But for us, the draw was two other people. Was first off was John Wagner, the co-creator of Judge Dredd.
Indeed.
And Johnny Alpha Shotgun Dog, two of my favourite comic strips. And the second was a chap you'll hear us likely go quite a lot about, is Cosmic Jim, aka Jim Starlin.
Cosmic Jim Starlin, who I suppose for certain readers, people might not have heard about him, but what happened recently is some film came out called Marvel Avengers Assemble. Now, we're going to spoil it, because frankly, it's been out for long enough. So, if you're waiting for the DVD, skip forward about 15 minutes.
Yes.
Because we're going to talk a lot about it. But anyway, in the very last frame, literally, of Avengers Assemble, you see the villain behind all the various machinations revealed as a giant purple dude who turns and grins at the camera. Now, he's not named on screen, so if you don't know who he is, you're just a general cinema goer, or again, or maybe you got into Marvel Comics more recently, or the younger reader, you might not know who he is, you just think, oh, who's that, what's going on?
That is Thanos of Titan.
Thanos of Titan is one of my favourite comic characters when written, and are drawn by Jim Starlin.
Yes.
I'll let Andy give you the exhaustive history very shortly, because his memory is better than mine with this sort of thing.
It's true.
But generally, it was a real coup to have someone over, because obviously actually having someone fly over from America rather than the local talent, I imagine probably costs a wee bit more, requires a bit more organisation and a bit more negotiation to make it worthwhile for the guests to bother to attending. So that was quite good. He wasn't the only one that was due. Mike Plug was due to come over, but for some reason didn't appear. I have no idea why. But Cosmic Jim Starlin came over, and he was there the full weekend, and it was an absolute joy to see somebody like that, because you just don't expect to have someone there unless you go across to, well, an American convention, or maybe failing that, one of the big London ones. But to be able to, well, get to see him very quickly and cheaply, because that's another thing we should mention in Glasgow Comic Con's favour, is it was very cheap for the convention.
£25
for the whole weekend. And signings, basically a lot of the guests were signing for free, some of them were sketching for free, and some of them, if you wanted a more detailed sketch or stuff, they charged you for it. But like Cosmic Jim Starlin, for instance, was available all weekend signing stuff for free.
Doing free sketches,
and what was nice about him and some other people, like John Wagner, is that they didn't just turn up for the panel and go away and do their own thing. They were there all weekend and we're seeing stuff. And one of the more exciting points, I got to be in the same toilet queue as Jim Starlin, which got me more excited than words can say. And I did briefly think about letting him skip to go in front, but frankly, I have a dodgy bladder and there was only one cubicle. I couldn't wait. I did feel slightly bad. I felt bad when I was in there thinking, I could have let Cosmic Jim Starlin go for the pee in front of me. I'd be a legend, but I just couldn't. Anyway, so I will now allow Andy to give you the exhaustive history of who Thanos of Titan is, in case you don't know.
Well, Thanos actually predates Jim's tenure at Marvel, which is probably going to be very interesting in the world of comics and litigation for the next couple of years. But suffice to say, it was introduced in an issue of Iron Man that Jim Starlin took over.
Was that issue 55?
Yes.
Oh, good times.
Anyway, the long story is, on the moon of Saturn called Titan, there are Titans. Ruled by Mentor, the peaceful, benevolent chap who has two sons. One called Eros, who is fair and has the ability to make people fall in love with him. Can be construed as a little bit rapey, but anyway.
But it's not actually meant to be when it's written properly.
And he has his other son, Thanos, who wasn't benevolent, peaceful, but wanted power and to rule. He basically engineered a cataclysm on Titan, which killed his mother, and a lot, who was really the only person he cared about. He left, augmented through cybernetics, dark mystical arts, came back a beefier chap, Now, he's basically Marvel's sort of preeminent single cosmic bad guy. He has, on a number of occasions, faced a couple of the big guns. He started off as Captain Marvel was his villain, his hero, sorry.
Yep.
And then was introduced when Jim Starlin left Captain Marvel, during which he had it was a cosmic cube he used to try and achieve godhood, but he foolishly, instead of killing Captain Marvel, just aged him to an old man, and he still was able to smash the cosmic cube, thus shattering Thanos' illusions. It was during this time that Thanos turned to becoming not even so much a worshipper of death, but in love with the anthropomorphic personification of death who exists in the Marvel Universe. And so he was the champion of death, and he then got embroiled into Adam Warlock's title, where Warlock was set against his evil future self, the Magus, who was in fact meant to be the champion of life set against Thanos. Ultimately, thanks to Thanos' help, Adam defeats the Magus by absorbing his soul just on the point of death, merely 18 months after the events of the Magus battle takes place. Quite a bleak view.
Indeed, yes.
So, Thanos absorbs some of the energies from one of the gems that's on Adam's head, which will become very very important to the Marvel Universe in about 14 years' time. Anyway, Thanos kills Adam Warlock, his soul goes into the soul gem when his future self appears and takes it. Thanks to the intervention of the Avengers, the Thing and Spider-Man, Adam Warlock gets freed from his gem and basically Thanos gets turned to petrified stone. Now this was in 1977.
Yes.
Thanos then didn't appear save for the Death of Captain Marvel graphic novel, mm-hmm. which Jim Starlin wrote and drew, which was the end of Captain Marvel. And instead of it being the usual heroic battle, it was he succumbed to cancer. Mm-hmm. It was the first Marvel graphic novel, quite a powerful work, and should be noted that this, aside from the odd misdirect, Marvel let that character lie fallow now.
Yeah, which is a bit unusual.
The name has been used, but yep. The character lies fallow. So, 1990, Jim Starlin's writing the Silver Surfer title over at Marvel starts bringing back characters. So he resurrects Thanos, resurrects Adam Warlock and the like, and in the first of Marvel's sort of cosmic crossover events called the Infinity Gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, all of the gems, the gem that Adam Warlock had in his head is called the Soul Gem. It's one of the six Infinity Gems. When they're all possessed by the same individual, they have ultimate mastery over time, space, the soul, reality, mind, and the other one, yes.
I can't remember that.
So, Thanos then basically wants to do this to basically be an equal to his love, death. He then wipes out half of all life itself. Big cosmic crossover. Suffice it to say, Thanos loses the Infinity Gauntlet. All is good.
Indeed.
And there's a couple of other crossovers, and Thanos was involved in them for a while. The ultimate truth that Jim Starlin revealed for the character is that he was never going to have ultimate power. He was always going to lose it, because deep down he knew he wasn't worthy.
Yes.
And it's quite telling this happened in the Infinity Gauntlet, and also in the End and the Infinity Abyss.
Yes, because the crossovers. Cosmic Jim was saying it was supposed to be a disillusionment.
Yeah,
it was basically
dissatisfaction.
He said that's the whole point of the character, is this embodiment of dissatisfaction, which is a bit more complex and, well, interesting than general villains. Now, I like my wah-ha-ha-ha villains. They have their place, but what makes Thanos stand out, and what very few other writers have been able to do, is latch upon that sort of ennui that Thanos has, that he can never quite achieve his goal, and even when he does achieve his goals, it's never enough.
They lapse far too much into the lover of death, wants to destroy everything, a superpower about, which is a shame, because there are many talented people who have taken a stab at writing him, Mark Waid, Keith Giffen, and none have just quite clicked.
He is arguably one of those few comic characters to come out of one of the big two US publishers that is very much a writer's piece. And it's very much really one writer that can do it properly. And I said, people have tried, and there have been entertaining stories that happen to have Thanos in them, but it just doesn't work. So, hence the excitement to see Cosmic Jim, at this event.
Yes, so
as the main writer, yeah.
He was. He revealed he didn't get a comp ticket to go see Avengers, had to pay for it himself. And
indeed, he also mentioned that recently Marvel have been courting him to speak to him, but he basically isn't interested, and talked at length without being bitchy or whatever, just very frankly about what it's like to be a jobbing writer, artist in comics, and how sometimes you don't want to deal with some of the business practices of them, and yet there's times, as you said, where, well, I have to eat, or I have a family emergency, so I'll go back to Marvel or DC, and I'll work for them then, which is nice to see. It's nice to see someone talking normally. But just gone off slightly there, one of his anecdotes, which must be mentioned, is he was talking about working for DC in the 80s. Now, if you were around in the 1980s, you may recall that there was much hysteria, misunderstanding, and various, also horribleness, spoken about AIDS. And you remember there were big adverts that had AIDS written in giant rocks, and there were, the mountains were coming down, and everyone was going to catch AIDS, and it was all going to be very terrible. So various companies made this like an issue, like you would have the AIDS episode or something, or the AIDS storyline, and whatever medium you've got. So DC decided that they would do an AIDS comic, a comic about AIDS. Now, to put this into context, comics do tend to have a thing of, we're going to do an issue, like an issue about some problem, some social thing.
And in their defence, I don't see that is...
No, that's not context, yeah.
They do have to do it. And there are times, if you're actually... Speaking of comics about AIDS, I think if... and superhero comics in general generally don't tend to handle it well, but if you do want to read a very good one, I strongly urge tracking down Incredible Hulk 420 by Peter David and Gary Frank, involving former Hulk companion Jim Wilson.
Indeed.
But so DC had in their offices a suggestion box saying, we want to do an AIDS book about a character that gets it, so we can make a positive message about it.
Yeah.
And so they had a suggestion box.
A suggestion box for
everybody it. Knows is a bad idea.
Yeah, which character should get AIDS, basically?
Now, Jim Starlin had recently been asked to take over Batman. He'd been doing fill-in issues because after Frank Miller wrote Batman Year One, they didn't have a regular writer on the title.
Yeah.
It was fill-ins, and they didn't have... It's a difficult act to follow, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, he was doing enough fill-ins that he got given the green light to basically be the writer, and he kind of tried to shoehorn Robin out of the book because it's a stupid character. If you look at Batman,
yeah,
it's child endangerment of the highest order. It doesn't work in the sort of slightly modern conceit that they were trying to do at the time.
Yeah.
So Jim kind of...
Yeah, I think the point he made was, the whole point is Batman's supposed to be like in darkness and in the night and time. So why and mature as adult? So why would you put a teenager in brightly coloured clothing beside him?
Yeah. The bullet magnet.
Yeah.
So there was a suggestion box. So every time he was in the offices, he would put in Robin, Robin, Robin. But that's not the real amusing bit of the anecdote. Is, to be honest, when they tipped the suggestion box out, the number one character that people wanted to see catch AIDS in the DC universe was Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen.
Good fortune, Jimmy Olsen.
Now, the only thing that saved Jimmy Olsen from being killed off by AIDS in the 80s was the fact that the actor Mark McClure in the live-action Superman films, which were still a reasonable going concern at the time, was gay himself. So it was, and they were trying to move in the 80s, for those of you who are slightly younger than us old farts here, is that when AIDS was launched, it was the gay disease.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. That was the biggest problem. And it's thankfully something that's died a death to...
It's pretty much almost... Well...
I'd say there's some out.
Yeah, I'd say there's still some of that, but generally most people now realise that, well, anyone can catch it. Yeah.
But at the time it was the gay disease, and it was kind of, as you can imagine, America, some of the more colourful religious
corners.
Yeah. So obviously that's where... That's how Jimmy Olsen was spared.
Yeah.
But it did kind of...
They thought it would be in bad taste to put a comic out where Jimmy Olsen character catches AIDS when the actor himself, who played the character, who most people would associate with Jimmy Olsen at that time, was gay. So thankfully some common sense prevailed there. Because it would not, no matter how well intentioned, I don't think they would have come across well.
It would have been a very bad move. So But this the constant suggestion box stuffing with Robin led to the when they were looking to energise the Bat books, and the then editor had the idea of the phone in for Robin said, do you want to kill him off?
Yeah.
And that's kind of helped where Death in the Family kind of came from.
But then the problem that Cosmic Jim had is that when Death in the Family came out and was massively successful, other parts of DC started noticing that, hang on a minute, we sell lots of Batman merchandise. We've got lunchbox and towels and gigs and books and stuff that all feature this Robin character, and now you just killed him. And his work just dried up almost straight away. It just goes to show that you can have a popular success, but if you're dealing with a large corporation, it doesn't mean you'll get work off them.
No. So Jim was the highlight and over both days. And to be honest, at the end of it, when he was quite embarrassed with the fact he had a standing ovation for quite a few minutes.
Yes, because his main talk finished at the convention. So the other main thing to touch upon, I think, is John Wagner, and a particular anecdote from John Wagner, which I still find trouble getting through my head. For context, John Wagner, how do you describe this? He initially comes across as your stereotypical dour Scotsman.
You're sort of your dour Scots uncle stroke granddad.
Yeah, the sort of uncle stroke granddad who sort of sits in the chair, mumbles away to himself, looks generally unhappy all the time, and just demands, where's my pipe, possibly my slippers. This is not to slag the man off, because it's just, you know, he was good value, he was a good guest, but he's not someone that's going to crack an anecdote. And it does make me laugh as well, because you associate him with primarily with Judge Dredd, who is this very taciturn, doer, unpleasant chap. And John Wagner is not unpleasant, but somehow it just sort of fit. So you've got John speaking in that very Scottish, you know, hello, how are you? Kind of I am jolly sometimes, but not as much. Talking about that, when he revealed in response to a question, a certain anecdote, and the question he was asked was, if you weren't working in comics, is there something that you'd really love to do instead? And John said, yeah, I'd quite like to raise chickens and sell eggs. I'd quite like to be a chicken farmer. And I was sitting in my chair going, ho, 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 very good. But then it got better when he revealed that he has in fact been raising chickens himself in the village that he stays for several years now. Has about 20 hens, and he sells the eggs to the local villagers. And just about makes enough to basically pay for their feed. And it annoys him slightly that he can't make more money out of it. And it's just delivered in such a droll manner, and amongst all his anecdotes about all the violence and murder that's in Judge Dredd. And he just had this image of Judge Dredd just selling chickens, and that just made my day. It was so much more interesting than usual replies. So, when he retires, he's just going to raise chickens.
And he has kind of... It's quite ironic talking about the mega epics where we're big fans of Dredd, and how he kind of said this time that the most recent one, Day of Chaos, is the one where he's actually followed through in it. Because almost every other big event, they've taken Dredd at Mega City 1 to the brink of it all going Tango Ultra. Then they pull back.
Yeah.
This time round, no, Dredd's still there. The city's just been totally fucked up beyond belief.
Yes, there were 400 million people at Mega City 1. There's now 50 million
in
the same amount of space. So he's hopefully got something there. And he was just generally talking about his career. And another interesting thing he was talking about, which makes me go into one of my hobby horses, is related to decompression in comics. Decompression in comics is when, I don't know, you're a writer of some description, and instead of giving me a interesting storyline, you spend 5 pages of someone walking across a room. That kind of nonsense.
It's the comics and cinema have a horrible, horrible symbiosis where the one feeds into the other and gives the other habits and tricks. Now, in the early 2000s, comics took the wanted cinematic approach. Now, when done well, it's very effective. Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch and the Authority, perfect example of it, because while it was cinematic and it wasn't dense with text, there was a lot to absorb and there was a lot to read. Unfortunately, every book saw this and thought, everybody loves this, we'll all do it.
Yeah, and I would say that the worst form of decompression I've seen were, and I didn't read all of them because I didn't really enjoy them, but the ones I read of Mike Costas run on Transformers for IDW, one of the reasons why I dropped the book were endless scenes, which usually lasted at least 5 pages, I noticed, where you'd have two characters talking to each other, and in one panel, character A would say a sentence, And panel B, panel two, character B would reply. And then panel A, character A, you know. So you would have a conversation which sometimes could have literally been done in one or two panels, which would take five pages. Anyway, this is important to the point about, say, relation to this anecdote where Mr. Wagner, when he started working in comics, he used to do romance comics and the like. And for British comics of the time, for D.T. Thompson and such publishers, the norm for stories was often two or three pages. And he was talking about how he quite enjoyed working two or three pages, and the idea in 2000 AD of sometimes got you five or six pages felt like complete luxury to him. And it was like, whoa, I've got all this space now. And even to this day, and this was in relation to him talking about how he felt he hadn't really got on with American comics writing, is that he still prefers to structure things in like six pages at a time and tell a story in six pages where you resolve a cliffhanger, move the story on, and then you have another cliffhanger. And frankly, that is the way comics should be.
Yep, serial storytelling. He also talked about Batman was really the only character, because he has no stomach for superheroes, yeah, but Batman he could actually understand.
Because Batman was just Dredd,
yes,
basically. So that's how he was good at writing it. So again, you know, it was nice to hear someone talk with refreshing frankness. Because sometimes I get quite annoyed with certain comic websites when I interview people, and you just ask them banal questions and you get banal answers back.
The good thing is that, yeah, everybody there was quite open and upfront. I think hero of yes, was Rufus Daigle, who is a swearier, edgier version of Nick Roach.
Yeah, he's just like a very angry, sweary Nick Roach. And that, although he would give very frank opinions, like he was asked about, you know, what do you think about comics today? And he would say, I think they're fucking shite. And he would be he would turn the air blue. And it was probably my only kind of criticism, I suppose, of the event, is that I found Mr. Daigle, who I had no idea who he was beforehand, but he entertained me enough, I might have a look at some of his work, is that there were a lot of children there, and they'd done a very good job of getting a lot of kids and families along. And maybe my suggestion for the future is maybe briefing the guests a bit and saying, so I like to be frank, but watch your F's and B's a wee bit. And it's just one of those, it's not a huge thing to jump up and down about, because a lot of these guests and conventions are often aimed at adults or held in convention centres or hotels, but also it wasn't a church, and being an ex-Catholic, it still feels a bit wrong when people get up on the stage and you know, swear. And that was something to bear in mind, because a few times you were like, this isn't quite suitable for the kiddies. So either maybe having such talks at a certain time, or maybe just saying beforehand that, you know, this is more of an adult panel, and there might be some language. We'd probably solve that. Again, that's just teething problems which can be easily sorted out. There was a cosplay.
Yes.
In which Doctor Strange entered and did not win.
The chap who was Doctor Strange for me was absolutely splendid. Just looked and thought, brilliant. For he even had great his temples.
Yeah, he was good. He even did the movements of the Doctor Strange, and very ingenious costume, made clearly on a budget of about 5p. Like, he had yellow rubber gloves for the gloves, but somehow they worked.
Yes.
And they were fine. And there was another two cosplays, and the second day, Batman went in the pulpit for a while, which was a nice, surreal sight. Generally went on. The dealer room wasn't, probably because they moved some of it across the way, it wasn't anywhere near as heaving as last year, so you could actually get around it much easier, but it was always busy. And a very large and plentiful supply of 50p boxes, which are quite approved of.
Which are, as we like to call them, ammunition.
Yes, ammunition, yeah. And again, it's good, because that's part of the joy of these things, is just rifling through the cheap bins and going, I could buy some cheap comics, or, again, even, you know, it's good for kids, if you're trying to encourage kids along. So that was fine. So we could go on all day, but we won't.
We'll just say that all the guests were a fantastic value. One of the best things was at the end, when the Grant Morrison Frank Quitely panel on the Saturday was, so many people queued up to sign. The two of them worked the lines, and nobody went away not getting anything signed. Yeah. It was, did enjoy Grant Morrison's talk. He was quite diplomatic about the subject of Watchmen, which was only briefly broached, and nobody actually asked the hard question about really what do you think. It's just, it was something that before Watchmen really didn't get talked about.
Yeah, because he was asked about updating the storytelling techniques of Watchmen, and without slagging off or criticising the current stuff, he did address it more in terms of, well, it's more interesting to look at how they told a story
and
advance, and look at the way Watchmen was told, and advance that forward rather than just take the characters and do more stories about the characters, which, to be honest, I think is a more, I would say a more intelligent approach to updating Watchmen than just hear some more stories with the characters. Briefly, regarding the four Watchmen, I can't tell you what stories I like because I've got no interest.
I acquired one of the issues, quite banal, just not interested. The stories were already told. Now, I did say earlier, before we go on to our next topic, the reason why Ralph's a little bit hacked off is we're going to talk, because we normally have these recorded almost a month in advance, but due to real life issues, we've kind of, the inventory's been exhausted, so we're actually
unusually topical this time.
Yes, so we're talking about basically the comics that Ralph and I have been waiting more than 20 years for.
21 years for, to be precise.
And they're here.
Yeah, for 20.
Not before fucking time.
So we speak, of course, for the next wee while. Oh, for fuck's sake. I'll talk about why I've just sworn a wee second. Anyway, for the next wee while, until the end of the show, is Transformers Regeneration 1. Now, I'm swearing because, being the uber fan I am, I, even though I had the paper copies on order, read Haze earlier, bought a paper copy. I felt kind of foolish because I thought, well, I've waited 20 odd years for this comic, I'm going to buy all the paper versions and all the download versions, which I don't usually do. And I can just get the download version when I get home. It's now been trying to download this for approximately 40 minutes and it's still not working. I'm not happy, I want my fucking download, pardon my language.
Yes.
Just keeps giving me errors and requesting and errors. It did download the free issue which already came out 2 months ago, which I have, and I've got my paper copy, but I want a fucking digital copy. Anyway, the reason why is because, long story short, I read it and actually really enjoyed it, like genuinely enjoyed it, but just in that nostalgic haze.
So,
what's the plot of,
Transformers ended.
It's downloading now. It's finally gone.
victory. Transformers.
I think that's just because they started talking about
probably.
It.
Probably. It's like calling down.
Right. Okay. So Transformers. Yeah.
Ended for US readers with issue 18. For us, about 9 months later with issue 32, when Marvel discontinued the license. Now it came back with Generation 2 a couple of years later. But. Recently, there's been some clamouring from people to revisit the classic stories from Marvel, partly due to a lot of unanswered questions about some of the storylines, and also at the time due to quite a vocal level of dissatisfaction with the then current Transformers comics. I should point out the landscape significantly changed in the last year, thanks to Messrs. Barber, Roberts, Roach, Milne.
They got good again, basically.
Collar and Griffiths, so they're good, but people have been clamouring for that, and Andy White, there was an internet petition. Simon Furman's always amenable to revisiting his classic Transformers universe, having done it for several conventions over the years on an unofficial basis, and Andy Wildman said he had an idea for something, and what started out was pitched just as a 6-issue mini, which is kind of a lot of IDW's model for publishing at the time. It kind of grew arms and legs of its own and has become a continuation for 20 issues to take all the way up to issue 100. So the challenge for it is obviously it's continuing a comic that was last published 21 years ago, so a lot of things have moved on.
Yeah, and there's
particularly
also, not just
the production side.
The production side of it, yeah.
So there's been quite a wait for us because it was greenlit a while ago and it's been worked on. And there have been tantalising hints, but obviously there was a lot of back and forth behind the scenes to try and get it to work on its own, but also feel like a legitimate continuation, because I think that's probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
Is it to get new readers, because there are people who are new to Transformers comics through IDW and through Dreamwave and more recent cut, who will buy it because it has Transformers on it. The people that are going to be the difficult ones to please are sitting on this couch right now.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and also the big problem as well, as Furman has said, is not just to make it a pointless nostalgic cash-in or just a wee warm glow thing, to actually make it a legitimate proper story, and also actually for one of the very rare times in any Transformers media, actually wrap everything up and bring it to a proper conclusion, as in it will end at issue 100.
Yes.
And that is it. Now obviously we understand the commercial realities, and if it sells well enough, then yeah, I wouldn't be too surprised or even disappointed if a year or two down the line they said, oh, we're doing a little follow-up or whatever. But at least you know you will still have a full, complete storyline. And for those of us who started reading this thing at a very early age, it would be nice to have an ending, and generally with mythology and the like, one of the reasons why, for instance, I quite like the legends of Robin Hood and Camelot and stuff like that is they have an ending.
Again, Norse mythology is why I do enjoy that. There's an end. There's an end point, which is the biggest problem with comic franchises is that Batman never ages and packs in. Peter Parker always ends up being either a teenager or in his mid-20s. Transformers, they're alien robots. They can exist for millions of years, so yes, they can go on, but they allow... The only other character that does that is Red.
Yeah.
To go back, it's...
It would be a good time to bring it off, because at this point, the IDW Transformer comics have been going since October 2005, so there already is another comic universe that you can quite easily follow and get into and have it done in the modern style.
And has its own arms and legs, and is a decidedly different beast. Certainly in recent months... It's stamped its own, it's made a play for, this is a distinct telling of Transformers, here is why you should be paying attention to this. So, Regeneration 1, so there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. So, biggest concern is obviously the whole creative team, so obviously Simon Furman and Andy Wildman back on board. Best of it is Stephen Baskerville back on inks. Having seen Andy Wildman's art in a lot of Marvel US over the years and seen how badly some of the inkers treated it, it was good to see some back. So I do like when Andy inks his own work. Yeah. A lot of his black and white stuff from Marvel back in the day was amazing. And some of his covers for IDW, the sort of scratchy European style, was brilliant. But whenever someone else inks his work, it's never, basketball aside, I've never really been happy with it. It's never looked kind of quite like the Wildman that we see. So he got that back on board. So now we go to the biggest nuts and bolts and the biggest changes in comics, production-wise, the letters and the colours.
Indeed.
So I think it's Chris Murray's doing the letters, and he's aping the old style Marvel balloons with the sort of square ones with the little staticky lines at the top.
That's correct.
To make it feel. And colours now. We have a cover colourist, Jason Cardi, who's doing something not too dissimilar to Wildman's watercolour palette when he was painting some of his covers. Not exactly watercolour, but it evokes a feel for it.
It's also quite close to Wildman's own colouring on his own IDW covers over the last few years.
Yes, so something there. And we have a relative newcomer and friend of the pod, Mr. John Paul Beauvais, on colours. Interior. Now, what they've done is, it does look like a modern comic, but it also looks like an old comic as well. The palette choices aren't a million miles away from the old process colours that they used to use.
Yeah, it's like it's given it various gradients and the like, but it still has that old style of the robot as a green robot, not the robot as 10 million shades of green and the like, and clear, bold backgrounds as well. And obviously the part of the point as well is that, again, to make it feel like a proper continuation, if you make it look 100% like the old comics, what's the point?
Because we've already got them.
So it's a tricky balancing act, and I think they've pulled it off even more successfully than the free issue, to be honest.
It's something that we kind of, and with most comic creators, once they get into a rhythm and get their groove on, that's where it will happen. So, fantastic.
It's...
So as you can tell, we really love this, so it's now about time we really should talk about the story.
Okay, so the story is, we start off with... simulation sequence where Bludgeon, the evil Bludgeon, he was the nasty pretender chap with the skeleton.
He did in effect take over leadership in the latter issues of the Marvel run from the sitcoms following the Unicron Assault.
He appears to be attacking Cup, the heroic Autobot warrior. However, it's not in fact an attack, it's a simulation. And we learn through this that Cup basically is, he's not having a good time, he's not really happy with the current status quo on Cybertron, which has apparently been in peace since the last comic. Sorry, since 20 years ago.
Yes.
And that's been going on. So then Springer comes up and has a wee chat with him, and Andy will take over. Because I'm very bad at spots.
Yeah. Well, basically what's happened is, just to go back, 80.5, which we talked about on Startup 80.5, had your post-war Cybertron is basically still in its kind of infancy of its new set and status quo. Last Autobot was watching over Cybertron. Prime was in a little ivory tower mentoring Hot Rod and kind of out of touch and putting his head in the sand and just trying to be really optimistic about the future. Meantime, Soundwave and some Neo-Decepticons were manoeuvring to try and sort things out, and the issue culminated with destruction of the Last Autobot. So, a game changer from there right away, and kind of taking off a big magic hand-wavy device off the board. to stop any tendency for, oh look, he can fix everything. Mm-hmm. So no reset button, he's already been vaporised. So
again, if you haven't read the free issue, it is mentioned in dialogue.
Yes, yeah, so all of this will be will become clear. So basically, Cup is pretty much thinks that Prime's put his head in the sand. Magnus is trying to keep a peace and trying to put a lid on things. A couple of Decepticons have smuggled in and got some warheads and are trying to do something. So a bit of a hostage situation. Well, not so hostage situation, but a kind of big bomb threat.
Big bomb threat, which, you know, we've got a big bomb and we're going to do something nasty, so...
Cup and the Wreckers, meanwhile, offer to kind of go in and sort stuff out, but Magnus is trying to negotiate and all that, because he doesn't want any martyrs, because obviously the Decepticon movement's downtrodden as it is just now, mm-hmm. and looking at it from the point of view for the Autobots, the Decepticons are a terrorist movement, so martyrs are the worst thing that you can create.
Yeah, and it's a clever use of remembering the fact that they're robots, because for them 21 years is nothing. Whereas they've been fighting Decepticons for millions of years.
21 years is an eye blink.
It's less than a cough. And we've seen sort of attempts at peace before. They've broken down. So you can understand why they're a bit jittery.
But in the background of all this, Soundwave is watching, who is, as Simon Furman said in his blog, he's taking his cue not from the Marvel US run, but from the Marvel UK run, where he's not necessarily ambitious to lead himself, but it's basically running the show at the moment, and is very devious, but a background player, keeping it low-key, not the ostentatious ranting or massive thing ahead of other characters. So he goes to the couch and he uses his chest device to eject some Transformers.
Which I quite enjoyed, because they are the Deluxe Insecticons.
Yes.
And it's quite clever, because we forget that Soundwave has the capacity to eject things from his chest. Which makes sense when you have smally Transformers, so you can hide them in the chest and he ejects them, and pleasingly the Deluxe Insecticons are used for the purpose, because their size fits with the storyline, their function fits with the storyline. They're not just there to be wanky, oh look, some toys that weren't in the comic before, let's put them in, which is something that has plagued many a Transformers comic over the year.
So inside the thing, there are obviously some characters that from the sort of later era, Terra Dive,
Eagle Eye,
and Afterburner. So it's giving you sort of, here are some of the other characters. Now it's plain that they're no mark characters. They are cannon fodder, really.
Indeed.
But in a war, that you're going to have some of them. So they're basically trying to manoeuvre an explosion of one of the devices to cover their escape, because they don't want to get caught. The Insecticons appear and basically take them out, because they want to use them, they want the factory to explode and have the Autobots blamed on it to get more people to go to the Insecticon cause. Well, they don't, Soundwave does, so they're going to do what he tells them. So they basically take out the three and they get ready to rig one of the explosives to go off properly.
But look, it comes through the door!
The Wreckers come in and, in true elite force fashion, take them out inside a couple of panels.
Yeah.
It's not a big protracted battle scene.
No, it's not. There is no decompression in this comic.
This is an elite commando unit.
Yes.
And shows you they're an elite commando unit without a protracted battle. It's just, we're in there, threats neutralised, they're at the warhead, they get it stopped so it doesn't blow up. We then cut to the Nova Point, where Prime's sitting looking at a map. Basically, Magnus is saying that Wreckers should get censured for their actions. Prime saying, I would normally agree, but however, he did spare life.
Yeah, and this again fits in with the character.
And he's not really paying attention to Ultra Magnus, he's looking at his star map, and then basically gets the ominous words, evil is infinite, Optimus Prime, I am coming to kill you again.
Ooh.
And it's Unicron. Whether this is a vision or basically Prime hallucinating, it could go on of either ways, because he's mentoring Hot Rod to pass on whatever's going to be. So. Yeah. There is the assumption, is he going to allow this to segue into...
But what makes it interesting, and perhaps as a potential use of Unicron, even if it is a lead-up to Unicron appears in issue 100, is that in this particular continuity of Transformers, Optimus Prime died not that many issues ago while plunging into Unicron with his magic matrix device. Now, who knows what really went on there? Because he just did the matrix and he flew around and...
He released the essence of Primus.
So... there could be some connection with Unicron. Is Unicron still connected to Prime in some manner? Did his rebirth have anything to do with Unicron? Is it related to Primus in any way, who died at the same time? is even a wee nod perhaps to using some of the future UK stories where you had the idea of unicorn hunting the Matrix that Rodimus Prime had, that sort of idea. So it's interesting, it got me going and I thought, ooh, what's going on there, rather than
oh god, it's
unicorn again. Also, it has that nice sort of melodramatic edge that characterises Furman's Transformers work, and to be fair, most of the Marvel one where he's like, oh, I'm going to kill you, and then Prime looks really sad. I like that. Also, this whole sequence done less than 2 pages.
Yep. So you then have Cup and Hot Rod having a bit of an argument out there, and Hot Rod basically saying, Grimlock went away, go get Nucleon fixed. Prime's burying his head in the sand, he's mentoring you, he's passing the buck, I'm not interested, I can't live like this, this isn't what we should be doing, our head's in the sand. Hot Rod basically cops to, Prime's better me, I'm not an idiot anymore, I'm not going to do a knee-jerk reaction. So, moving the character from Hot Rod to, obviously, ultimately, to where Prime wants him to be is Rodimus Prime.
Yeah.
So, it'll be interesting to see what journey this character takes, because I can't see him going all the way to Prime's vision.
No.
I can't see him going all the way back, so there's scope there for something new. So, Cup wanders off, speaks to the Wreckers and says, look, I'm going to go a tour of wherever everything's been from the Great War, and basically, he doesn't explicitly state what he's going to do there, but the inclination is to find anything that's been left over and to find what the Decepticons are up to.
Kind of the idea that we've had this war, we've touched other planets, we've completely ignored those other planets, we should go and have a look and see what's going on.
What has happened? So the Wreckers all decide to go along with them. So now what we should do is, before we go to the next bit, is talk about the Wreckers.
Yes.
Reason being is the Wreckers, obviously, thanks to Nick and James, have become popular in not just in Britain.
Yes, yes.
Whereas we've all known and loved them for years.
For many years, the Wreckers were, I wouldn't say obscure. If you're a UK fan and you're into comics, you knew who they were. And even if you're a UK fan and you weren't into the comics and you did probably be into the cartoons, Target 2006 and the like, were the stories everyone read.
Yes.
Whether you're into the comics or not. If you're into Transformers, you read it.
So we have a Wreckers lineup, and it's basically Springer, Sandstorm, Broadside, Roadbuster, Whirl,
the other chap,
Topspin, and Leadfoot.
Leadfoot's the new one.
Leadfoot's in G2, so yeah. it kind of skirts around a couple of things from UK continuity, which means because Roadbuster, as I said, in 8.5, he was vaporized in Time Wars. Whirl just kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Topspin had his head torn off, so he could come back.
Yeah.
So, and they also have Rack and Ruin.
But to be honest, it's one of those things where
I'm along for the ride.
Well, the way I look at it is, we've seen them come back from horrific death before, and there are 21 years between the last event. So even if it's never explicitly stated, for instance,
there is
these dead people came back to life, he can just go.
We retrieved his brain or just.
Yeah. 21 years later, anything could happen.
Yeah. So, but it's good to see the Wreckers there, and as I say, quite effective in their appearance.
It's also possibly one of those things that might be helpful to any Transformers readers who read the regular WWE comics and go, I'll try this, I'm not really sure. Oh, the Wreckers, I know who the Wreckers are.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a hook that might get people interested to read the next issue when they might go, it's a nostalgia thing, it's not for me, I'll stick to the regular comics.
So we cut to the Decepticon headquarters in Polyhex in Fort Psyche, and Soundwave is sitting in a room. Don't know what he's doing, but it looks like he's having a think. Mm. Basically, gets interrupted by a communication from Bludgeon, who basically says, I've been up to shenanigans for the last 20 years since we got gubbed in the last issue, but I'm back, but I need a favour from you.
Mm.
And basically promises Soundwave in return more firepower and dispensable bodies to wipe out the Autobots.
Yeah.
And in the background, there is what looks like a pretender chamber.
Yes, and that looks like the shape of Thunderwing.
Yes,
which I got very excited about.
So it's like, so as you can see, and that's done on the page, we're setting up, so we get to.
This made me happy.
We get the Autobots use their shuttlecraft to get to Earth. Now it's a while away, so they hitch a lift with
the Cosmic Carnival!
Still run by Berko 20 years on.
Yes, yeah, Berko is a long-lived human, it would seem.
Yep.
Now, things like that make me happy, because one of the things that I get intensely irritated about in Transformers comics is what people call Easter eggs, and what I call wanking, which is when they just randomly shove in references to other stuff, and it's just there on the page, and you go, look, it's Berko, whatever. this kind of works because it's part of an old continuity restarting again. So instead of going, it's Berko again, I was happy to see him because it's the same character from an old comic.
And also,
in context,
it's not just a reference, it's like, okay.
It's also a mention, yeah.
They have to get to Earth. It's a nice way of doing it. It's about remembering, you know what, here's what we've done. So they're in Earth orbit, they release some surveillance drones.
And this is when it gets, well, unexpected.
Yes.
Yes.
Basically, Earth's been completely destroyed. You see scenes from San Francisco, Paris and Tokyo of absolute, utter devastation. So this has been going on for the last 20 years. And it's said that it's not recent, so we've been sitting with our heads in the sand in Cybertron. Mm. So what's been happening here? Then surveillance drones hijacked.
And we see...
Well, we hear it, first of all.
Yes.
At last, really, go to the next page. Megatron sitting there going, what must someone do to get some attention around here? And basically sending some missiles to take out their ship. That's how the issue ends.
Yeah. Now, I quite like the idea that the Megatron has been apparently been sitting in his chair for 20 years, just kind of humming a wee tune to himself, thinking, right, I've blown up the Earth. When are the Autobots going to turn up? Dumpty dumpty dum. Bit of elevator music, what's going on here? And he turns up. And it's just a great bit of dialogue. It's genuinely good dialogue. It's like, what must one do to get some attention around here? As if he's a bit pissed off. That's how you end an issue, because you have the big shocks of, I didn't expect Earth to be told.
No.
For issue one at all. And yes, there was a cover that showed Megatron in a chair, but I didn't think it would be him in the chair of post-apocalyptic Earth. That was unexpected. And then, it's just getting a decompression. Here's a laugh, fire some missiles, the spaceship's blown up, come back next issue to find out what happens next. Very good.
Yes.
Very good. Very good cliffhanger.
And again, not just the nostalgia exercise, it has changed the game. Now, that's incorporating a little bit of an element of G2 there, where obviously San Francisco was told near the end, but it's moving the story on. It's
also cleverly done, because with it being sort of the first proper issue, because not everyone will have seen the free issue. Only the free issue is now available in Comixology, as of today. But not everyone will have seen that, because free comic book day out comics can be either very hard to get or impossible, depending on where you live. And even if you do live near a comic shop, whether you could get to one in time. And stuff like that. So because of that, there is a lot of talking in the issue. There is a lot of setting up. And I can imagine for some readers who are maybe picking this up on a whim or the fuss or not as ingrained in it as might go, yeah, it's all right, but it's a bit kind of a dull, not a little action in it. That's how you get them back. Blow up the Earth, then have Megatron try to kill everyone in the last few pages. It gives you a nice hook, gives you a bit of action, gives you a bit of unexpected, makes you go, I think I might come back to the next issue. So he's pretty much, Foreman, I think, has done a very good balancing act of trying to appeal to everyone. And if the comic tanks, if it doesn't sell well, then I don't think it's for trying. I don't think it'll be because of the quality of the book.
No.
If it doesn't sell well, then it'll be one of those things, I think, where maybe there just wasn't as much of a market as they thought, or maybe lots of people filled out a petition who had no intentions of buying it, which sometimes does happen. Other mention must be made as well of the comic in terms of the artwork. Obviously, we mentioned the colouring. I can't fault it at all. I did think the colouring was good in 80.5. I wasn't quite 100% on it as everyone else. I thought it was good. There was something I couldn't quite put my finger on, but at no point in this did I think there was anything wrong with the colouring. I think it's absolutely excellent. I think it's spot on. It's good colouring. I have nothing to fault. I love the look of it. And yeah, full marks. Full marks as well to the artwork. Now, what must be mentioned is Andrew Wildman is not a regular comics artist anymore. He works in computer games, storyboards, Doctor Who, and various other shows.
And films.
And Lonnie has done some comics works. He did Frontier, a Western comic for a British company called the DFC. He's done a few wee bits and bobs for NW, some small strips for Titan and the like. He's not been a regular comic artist for probably going on, 50 years? Really?
10, I would say. Because he's done a lot of Power Rangers stuff.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Power Rangers from the UK, which was probably about 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah, so I'd say that.
But in terms of a 22-page monthly...
War Within, the last time.
War Within, and that was 6 issues. So you would expect it to be a bit rougher on the edges, but to be honest, I actually think it looks better than some of his work in Marvel. The Inkenberg Baskerville is also spot on. Again, Baskerville not really a main comics guy these days. And I don't know if he's retired or if he maybe does work and things I don't see, but he's not regular gigs. So to have him put out something of this quality, which to be honest matches up just as well with any of the modern IDW comic books in terms of quality of artwork, storytelling, general look, it's absolutely superb. I've even taken my nostalgia filters off. I really can't fault it at all. It's a good looking book.
Yep, and again, one that we'll be sticking around for the till the end.
Yes, and I was going to buy the issue, let's be honest, but I'm actually genuinely looking forward to next issue in terms of just, well, I'll pick it up because of it's Marvel. So what you should do is, if you have any interest in Transformers, you should order the paper copy, or go on Comixology, or IDW's app, and get yourself a digital version. Or do both, and give it a try. And if you try 81, again, if you get it off Comixology, you can get 80.5 for free as well, so good value. And try it. If it's not your cup of tea, fair enough, yeah. You're giving it a go. But give it a go.
Yep. You must.
And then my comics downloaded and I'm happy again. And I believe you reached the end of the podcast.
Oh, no, because we're talking about things that were old that we're experiencing anew. We just
need to... Oh, of course! I forgot, because we've talked so long about that, we've actually went over our allotted running time.
It's a bumper episode.
It is a bumper episode.
So, I set Ralph a challenge.
It's true. We've mentioned this challenge before, but for the purposes of, well, everyone... Let's mention that again. Very briefly, the flat I currently rent is 5 minutes walk from a cinema. That cinema does a pass where for £15 a month I can see as many films as I like. This meant that last year I saw 50 films at the cinema. Then Mr. Turnbull gave me a challenge. He said in 2012 he must go and see 100 different films. The only rules are, it's okay, it can be an old film with a new film. It can't be a documentary. I can see documentaries, but I can't get them as a feature film. And no matter how bad the film, I must sit all the way through it. I'm not allowed to walk out of any films.
This has hurt me on a couple of occasions, Top Cat.
Indeed. So, as part of this, as of current recording, I've seen 63. It's becoming a bit of a chore, because a lot of the films I've seen recently have been, to be honest, quite bad. But what was a good film was a film from 1967, which was on as a one-day special. It was part of a season of promoting old British films that have been remastered and put them back in the cinema again, was a Hammer film from 1967 called Caterham and the Pit.
Yes, so I came on this because this has long been a favourite film of mine from my youth. I think I encountered it, well, I think Channel 4 on a Sunday afternoon.
Now, I will be honest and say that I do prefer the black and white Caterham films, which have a horrifically miscast chap as Professor Caterham investigating strange alien goings on.
On behalf of the British Walking
Group. On behalf of the British Walking Group. And I do prefer them because I saw them first and I just have a certain love of them. I had seen Caterham in the Pit once before on an afternoon and I thought that was okay. I don't think it was particularly brilliant, but I thought it was okay. But I thought I'd give it a go on the cinema screen, because what I found, particularly recently, was seeing Jaws in the cinema, is that sometimes seeing a film in the cinema is entirely different to watching it on television, and often much more enjoyable. So, we'd also like to point out that the day I went to see this, some film called The Amazing Spider-Man opened. We thought we'd see Caterham in the Pit instead.
True.
And the short review is that I enjoyed it. The plot, for those of you who don't know, which will be, well, many of you imagine.
There's renovation work going on a tube station in London to expand the underground, and what looks like unexploded bomb, probably from World War II, has been unearthed at the same site. As while this work is going on, they're digging up and are looking for archaeological finds while they're doing it,
mm-hmm.
and they find some evidence of a missing link, as it were,
yes.
to humanity. While this is going on, Professor Quatermass is being lectured at by some politician about the military getting involved in the British Rocket Group.
Mm-hmm.
Said military chap happens to be a bomb disposal expert and gets called to the site. Quatermass goes along with him.
Mm-hmm. The general chap is played by Gillian Glover, who many of you will know perhaps most famously as the villain from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, but also many, many another top quality telefantasy
and then of course as General Veers from The Empire Strikes Back.
Indeed.
And Scarlet A and all that from
Doctor Who, Side of Death.
And Richard the Lionheart in
and The Crusade, another Doctor Who serial, and many, many other things we could mention, but I won't.
And Quatermass is played by the chap whose name
is Andrew Keir.
That's it.
Scottish, the late Andrew Keir, good Scottish actor. Good beard acting as well.
Yes. And so they get embroiled in it. They eventually get into the device to find. It's obviously, it's not an unexploded bomb. It's been there for millions of years.
Indeed.
It contains Martians.
It does indeed contain Martians. I'm laughing because they do look slightly ridiculous. But you have to bear in mind the time it was made.
Special effects technology. If you're one of the people who can't make allowances for that, you're going to struggle for
that. There were quite a few giggles in the cinema when the Martians were revealed. Which is fair enough, to be honest.
So you're going to struggle with this. So ultimately, it transpires that the Martians were looking to colonise our Earth and were basically taking primates and breeding them to get them to be their colonists.
Mm, which is a nice idea.
Again, Chariot of the Gods, Eric von Daniken, and that became very...
And there's all sorts of stuff about the devil.
It's more that the...
The
capsule and the Martians have a defence mechanism, and it means that if anything that's unlike them looks like it's going to attack them, unexplained things happen, so it's kind of they become violent, there's explosions. All sorts of things in this particular area of London have happened over the centuries. Big upshot is that they try and get into the using like a better than diamond drill. And they keep trying to do it, and it releases some inner Martian within.
It releases a sort of Gurn virus as well that makes everyone Gurn furiously as they're overpowered by the terrible noises and the like.
And in our subconsciouses, there is the race memory of these Martians, which you can see in very grainy television using a device made by the crack scientist at Blue Pier.
Yes.
But the upshot is there's a couple of people who are immune to it, and but anyone who has this latent Martian stuff and it knows and basically kills them. So basically London goes completely tango ultra.
It's true, and everyone tries to kill each other, and
there's a big psychic projection.
Basically, which has got horns, kind of devilish.
Yeah.
What's going on there? And then it's defeated. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
Someone might want to go and see it now. Or get the DVD, or no, it's not on YouTube because I had a look.
It's get the DVD, and there's a Blu-ray remastered either just out or coming out very shortly. And it also has the bleak ending of Quatermass and the young lady who's assisted them just in the ruins. Neither of them can talk to each other, they just look.
They can do nothing but stand there in utter despair until the title cards finish rolling.
You can obviously think that I think John Carpenter had seen that before making The Thing.
Again, it's one of the things about British science fiction is they do tend to have terribly bleak endings.
It's been remarked by a lot of people, but purely because, obviously, we experienced such atrocities during World War II with the bombings and what have you. It informed our culture for a number of years.
And then many people who make stuff today grew up on all of this stuff, and it tends to get reflected again. And, you know, various commentaries and wars and stuff. They have a very pessimistic streak in the UK, which carries on. So, generally, in terms of what it's like to watch, there was much to watch. It was a very well done remastered job, which helped a lot as well, the quality of the film, because previously I'd just seen a grainy pan and scan version with adverts shoved in the middle. So that helped a lot as well. It looks very vibrant, looks like it was made yesterday. Seeing it on the big screen makes a big difference as well. So I enjoyed it far, far more, and got into it far more than going on. Another thing to bear in mind is it is one of those films that basically revolves around characters being inexorably drawn towards one set over and over. Those types of films where there's one set and there's one location and characters must go back and forth between it all times. If that can irritate some people, it just about gets away with it because of the running time. It got a bit more ludicrous if it went on longer. So that is that slight criticism to it, but again, this is not a high budget film, so you're not going to get car chases and big location scenes and like. As long as you can deal with that, that's fine. And take it in the context of the times, it's a perfectly serviceable, perfectly enjoyable old Hammer film. And if the new print turns up at a cinema near you, it was at Cineworld. I imagine it's probably doing the tour of some of the smaller independent cinemas along with the other Asian British films.
And if you can get
it, give it a go, or try and find a Blu-ray.
Yes.
Or if, like me, you haven't got a Blu-ray player, invent a Blu-ray player of your own using items from around your house. Build that, and then put the disc in that, and then hope it works.
Good luck with that.
So, talking of luck, I'm very hungry, and I want to stop this podcast so I can eat something now before we do another one.
It's true. It's time for a snack break. So, thanks very much for sticking around. We will
next time on Stardub, it will be a special about shit.
It won't be special.
It will.
However, we will be Transformers. Marvel has come back in a big way, and another franchise, well, tangentially related to it, is on its way back.
But what is that franchise? To find out the thrilling answer to this question, come back to this spatial time location in roughly two weeks from now. Goodbye.